Welcome to Startup to Scale, a podcast by Food Bevy. I'm your host, Jordan Buckner. Join me as I talk to aspiring entrepreneurs, seasoned industry experts, and everyone in between as we unlock the keys to growing from startup to scale. Today, I have the honor of speaking with Mike Fata, who is a prolific writer, mentor, and entrepreneur in the CPG industry. Mike co-founded Manitoba Harvest in 1998, which he grew for over 20 years until selling for $419 million. Since selling the company, Mike has now published a new book, Grow, which talks through 12 unconventional lessons for becoming an unstoppable entrepreneur, and has invested in a number of companies, including Nuts for Cheese, Midday Squares, and Soul Cuisine. So Mike talks with hundreds of founders and has a really good pulse on the industry. And so my goal today is really to learn what founders should do today in order to set themselves up for success tomorrow. Mike, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So building a company is obviously different now in 2023 than 1998, but I'd love to hear from your perspective how things have changed from when you started to what you see founders going through today.
Yeah, I think a lot of the fundamentals in business haven't changed, but there are some things that have. It relates to competition, really. Like back in before social media and, you know, a lot of data at retail, especially for CPG data, you could have a great idea or a great product and create a clear runway for yourself of maybe a couple of years before you're going to have stiff competition. We're not living in that time. And even if you create a great thing and it's very authentic to you, you maybe have 3 or 6 months before it's going to be copied. And certain categories get kind of copied really rapidly. And all of a sudden you have like half a dozen or a dozen competitors trying to do the exact same thing as you. And so that speed to market and access of information has really changed the game over the last number of years.
I like that you actually mentioned that business fundamentals have stayed the same, because that's one kind of time honored truth. But it seems that, you know, a lot of companies really in the last decade have taken this approach of, you know, hyper growth, right? So even me, when I launched my company, T-Squares, I honestly believed that I was going to grow the company and sell it within 5 years, right? Yeah. And like that didn't happen, and far from it. So what advice would you give to founders who are looking to, you know, quickly build and sell, as maybe has been popularized by technology or VC companies?
Yeah, I just don't think that you should be thinking like that. Foundationally, build a company because you like doing it, and build something that you're so passionate about that you'd want to do forever, and just focus on building a good company. If you do that right, then there could be a potential for you to sell the company one day. Where I see a lot of founders fail, and quite honestly, it's a turnoff for me as an investor, is when someone says, I'm building this company to sell it. You know, not to say that you shouldn't have a thought of an exit strategy, but I think it's been shown that founders and entrepreneurs that focus on that exit too early on can screw up a lot in business. And quite the opposite is true. If you just build a solid business and you enjoy the journey of being in business and you become, you know, known for quality and build a world-class company, hopefully, you're going to have every opportunity to sell that business when the time's right.
Yeah, I think that's key, because I think people see companies, right, that have large exits or acquire, and they think, oh wow, I want that to be me, without knowing the full story, right?
Yeah, and they think it's a process. You know, I'll also talk to a lot of founders that, yeah, I'm just raising my seed round, and then next year it's going to be a Series A, and then Series B, and then Series C, and then we'll sell the business like 5 years from now. You know, like, whoa. You know, you have to create a really differentiated product and a story and have a good enough margin in that business and gain the distribution and gain your minimum viable community and then a greater community, and do that all well, like, you know, being profitable or having enough equity to actually accomplish that. And all of that is near impossible. And you can't just think about, here's a funding round to funding round to funding round, and then you're going to be successful. Like, that's the Cinderella story. And hey, I have one of those stories from an exit, but we built the business over 20 years. You know, Soul Cuisine, my latest exit, Belshine, built the business over 25 years. And those are more of the real stories, even though the headline could just see, you know, 9-figure exit. And then everyone wants to dream that up.
But Mike, how else am I supposed to get my mansion by 25, right? If I don't build this company. I mean, you know, it's interesting, because even the other thing that I see, and interesting to get your take on this, is I see a lot of complicated products out in the market, right? And a lot of times it might start with a founder, you know, need that they're trying to solve for, but products that have 20 ingredients, even if they're all natural, or using like very unique and in some ways like odd, maybe they're beneficial, but like odd ingredients that no one has heard about on the consumer side. Do you think that the product industry has over innovated, gotten too complicated in the products that they're putting out into the market? Or do you think that you've seen the demand for things like that?
You know, it's a fine line there. You want to be highly differentiated when you're creating a product. And I think it's really important that you need to be, you know, there's got to be a really good fit with the founder, why the founder is creating that product. So, you know, if you're highly differentiated and, you know, to use your example, there's very unique or ingredients or novel ingredients in there, that could be your moat for a certain amount of time because you have a lock on that supply chain, or that's a really good fit with your founder story or whatever you're doing. And there's lots of great examples, right? Like I've been in the industry long enough, 25 years, that we saw when, you know, goji berries came being popularized and a number of other foods from around the world or superfoods or supplements. And so, you know, someone was early on enough to say, like, we're just going to take that risk and go for it. And it was an uphill battle. Same thing with hemp. When we were getting hemp to market, it was very, very strange and weird, but that was our differentiation. That's what made it unique, and just continuing on with that. So I think the flip side of that is also true, though. If you highly overcomplicate your product, you make your supply chain very difficult and one degree of separation, and you can't get that product, or you can't get it for the right cost, or you can't get it in the right time, you could be challenged in business just because of that. Or on the consumer end, like I think the consumers generally are going to, especially in the food business, more simple, like you'd make it at home, ingredient decks. And as more consumers are starting to read ingredient labels, they want to be able to understand what's actually on the label instead of, like, I think, highly engineered foods. I think there's less consumer draw to some of those things.
You know, I totally resonate with that because I was creating teasers as well. It's like, all right, let's make it as unique as possible. So essentially they were energy bars fueled with, you know, organic tea inside, but we use like tea as a main ingredient, including their name. We made them bite-sized squares instead of a typical protein bar shape. We made a multi-serve pouch instead of a bar, and or instead of a single serve. And then we also had flavors like citrus green tea matcha, which tasted great, but no one has ever tasted anything that was like a citrus green tea matcha in edible form in the grocery store. And to use your phrase too, right? Like, we built a moat that was differentiated, but we also built a moat around our consumers where they couldn't get in because they couldn't understand what the heck we were selling.
and you know, you realize as a founder, it takes so much money to actually go and market and educate people if there's any differences. Like when I learned that there's like 250 commonly eaten foods, and if you're outside of that, like how challenging it is to get a consumer to try it and become part of their normal lifestyle, it gets really, really tough. So you have to really choose where you're going to differentiate and be unique, but don't make it super complicated. You know, it's similar to even messaging. When we got into the hemp business, like telling people how healthy hemp was and how much essential fatty acids and how much protein and how sustainable and how organic it was, and realized that the majority of people didn't care that much. They wanted it easier to buy. And so just by simply changing the messaging up that hemp hearts were taste good, easy to use and good for you, made it a lot more approachable to the market to be able to come in and access the brand.
What are your thoughts on brands or the founders telling consumers that, like, this product tastes good? You know, it's interesting because it's highly subjective taste, obviously, and everyone has an opinion on it, but that's the number one survey point of, like, what most consumers are looking for from food is, like, something that tastes good. So, like, as a founder, how do you navigate that path of, one, making your product taste good, but then also sharing that message around taste?
Yeah, I think community is really important there, because you said it, like we've learned, especially some natural food products, a natural food consumer, and so in that natural food consumer community, would say this tastes good. If you put it to a mainstream consumer that's used to eating like highly processed, lots of sugar product, they're like, ooh, it tastes too earthy or too natural, you know? And so I think knowing what community you're talking to is important there. But generally, being in the food business for 25 years, I always said our biggest strategy is putting our product into people's mouths. Living in a time where you can have digital influence too. And so, you know, making food porn shots or having influencers that are showing how delicious the product is, I think all that's really, really important. But know who your target market is. And especially if you're making what would be called typically a healthier product, a lot of mainstream consumers just aren't quite ready for it yet to have that as part of their everyday diet.
You know, the industry is interesting. You've been in it for a long time, but it feels like there's been a little bit of shift to me where there's almost like two sides of this natural products industry. There's like the better ingredients led by organic, non-GMO certifications, but typically they're like standard foods that people have tried before. And then there's also this like food as medicine approach, which has almost led to a lot of foods performing as supplements and how they're marketed. How are you kind of seeing the market and like the product industry develop around those two ideas? Or do you see any others that are really standing out?
Yeah, I think there's healthier junk food, right? They're taking nostalgic kind of things, whether it's ice cream or treats, and make it a lower glycemic sweetener in there, or clean up the ingredient deck to not put additives or preservatives in it. And there's a huge market for those type of products. And those are making the world a healthier place. But then there's definitely foods that are sold on functionality, not just flavor and nostalgia. And I think that's where, you know, you're having a lot of ingredients that have some kind of beneficial, if they're energizing you, they're calming you, they're helping with your sleep, they're helping with your mood. I think those are the items that are popularized now from consumers of looking for that benefit. And so you see those kind of items, whether they're supplemented foods or just contain some of these ingredients, and founders are trying to share that benefit just in a different eating occasion.
Do you think founders hold themselves in by going after like functionality as their core message? And I ask because even I struggle with that and figuring, like we were talking about like focus and energy, but it's really tough because like, well, tea has caffeine, and for some people that gives them energy. For some, they think of it as like a relaxing beverage. So it's really all messaging around it. But you know, I don't seem to see too many companies kind of hitting plateaus around like functional language. I'm curious if you see the same.
I've learned a tremendous amount over it over the years. We did a very large consumer research project and marketing project, you know, a couple $100,000 spent. And what I learned from that, to highly summarize it, was in food and beverage, consumers care 75% on taste and 25% on benefit. And that 25% benefit is, from my understanding, all the benefits, you know, like, oh, it has ashwagandha, or it has this kind of herb in it that gives you this kind of effect, or it's organic, or it's sustainable, or that company is donating to social causes for the business, kind of all those benefits. But it's, you know, 25% when 75% is generated by taste, you know, that's still a little bit of a rounding error, you know, and if you don't get taste right, you're not going to have a lifelong customer. It doesn't matter how healthy it is, how sustainable it is. And so I think you got to be front and center focused on when you formulate on taste and that nutritional benefit that it's offering and all the other kind of benefits coming in tandem, but like right after the taste. I've made some poor tasting products that I thought were going to be awesome because hemp and other hemp foods were great. People loved it, that it had protein, essential fatty acids, and they just didn't sell. You know, people bought them once and they wouldn't buy them again.
Yeah, I think taste is highly under talked about and underestimated in the community, quite frankly. I see very few people like making really delicious food, or it's kind of second or third on the list. So I think that's something that should probably be highlighted by them. You know, taking a company and starting a company is really expensive. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, you know, how founders should fund their companies, especially those in the first couple of years, and the right time to take on investment to really grow.
Yeah, it is tough and every business is different. I personally like the farmer's market kind of approach to business, especially in food or food and bev, where, you know, you could start out and you have an idea and you make it in your kitchen first and you make it for your friends and family. So you think you have something because people like it and they're asking for it. And so you could make a run of like 100 or 200 and go to a farmer's market or go to a consumer or go to your local store and do a demo there and sell those products and sell that. But then also learn, you get feedback and hear from consumers and then ramp that up to 250 or a 500 piece run and learning all the way along, but also being responsible to make and sell where you're generating like cash flow and understanding what your product margins are before you scale up. So from a founding and a foundation of business, that's how I see the most successful companies really starting, especially if you start with, like most founders, limited equity. And then the gold standard for financing a business that I've learned is if you could bootstrap your business to $1 million in sales, which, you know, I couldn't do and the majority of people couldn't do, but it really sets you up after that for, you know, proper capital raising. If you don't have that money, before you generate $1 million in sales, it's got to be friends and family or angel investors from your local community, because most of the time they're investing in the idea, you know, they're investing in the entrepreneur. But, you know, until you have like $1 million business in consumer packaged goods food, you know, it's questionable if you're ready for any larger investments to really start to spend. Because I think, you know, you need to be $3-5 million company easy minimum before real financing, like a venture capital backed and start to spend to grow the business. So I see it fail by founders getting funded too early, spending those resources when they're not really sure where to spend, and they use up all the equity and they can't raise anymore.
You know, first off, I like the idea of farmer's market. I actually just saw a couple of posts by an entrepreneur named Lex Evan, who has Lexington Bakes, like gourmet brownie company. And he launched in farmers markets to support his launch in Erewhon. So you can like get in front of consumers and meet them outside of the store and use that to drive traffic in the store. And he said it was really successful at being able to do so. And I think that, you know, even limited time launches to really test it out with a plan of growth is really powerful. And on the funding front, you know, I think that bootstrap approach is so key. And I love that you said that. What do you kind of say to founders who are like, start off essentially kind of run out of money and they're like, okay, I need money and I need to find investors to even just get this off the ground. How do you like build those relationships with angels? Like if you don't have an immediate network, how do you make yourself presentable so that someone wouldn't want to invest in you, say like a local angel?
Yeah, I think, you know, get involved in the local community. And so if there's an opportunity to do an incubator or an accelerator for your business, that could be one avenue. Sometimes it's getting involved with the local university or colleges because they have entrepreneurship programs there. And there's a community of kind of angels and support hanging around there as well. Sometimes it's like a nonprofit, you know, we have like the Naturally Network across the US for natural product entrepreneurs or like similar organizations where you can get into that local community and go for minimal cost network. And then I would magnify that by, you know, being on LinkedIn. As I think about LinkedIn as a 24/7 trade show where you can go and tell your story and network with other, you know, whether it's angel investors or other founders on how they're finding a path to raise that capital and raise awareness for themselves and for their business.
What qualities stand out in founders to you personally that you either want to mentor or invest in?
I think a strong founder product market fit is number one. Like, why is the founder creating that product? You know, and I have my personal example of, you know, being 100 pounds overweight, getting into my weight loss journey, but doing that from the no fat diet. And so when I learned about hemp and essential fatty acids in hemp, I was hooked, you know. And so anyone that spoke to me in the early years of the business really got why I was into hemp foods. I'm looking for that in different business categories and different founders. Like, what are they really into? Give me an example. One of the portfolio companies, Bloom and Karen at Bloom, you know, was just sensitive and couldn't drink coffee, but wanted the coffee shop, wanted that experience, that latte experience, and created Bloom for herself. And then it took off from there because she met other like-minded consumers. But when you talk to her, you could really see how she has that product, that founder product fit. And so look for that, but also, you know, entrepreneurs that are smart, and you hear it all the time, like know your numbers, but you got to know your business, right? Like you have to understand how much your revenue projections are and how much margin that you're actually making. And I think that financial aspects of the business, it's hard to be successful without that. So founder product fit, and then being a smart founder and knowing the business well are the two foundations for me.
Yeah, I think those are so key as well. So I love that. And then as founders are growing, right, most founders start as like a single person or maybe a 2-3 person team. They're asked to wear all the hats, right? Be the finance person, be the marketing person, be the product development person. And most people, like, it's unreasonable to think that anyone has all of those skills. Maybe they're good at one of those or maybe two. And so how do you think about and recommend founders like start growing their initial teams as they're getting started to build up those skill sets and expertise?
Yeah, and I write about this. There's a couple chapters in the book on this, actually, because it starts with doing a personal SWOT analysis for yourself, understanding your personal strengths and weaknesses before, like, what you're really bringing to the business. I think if you're a sole founder, it's really tough. You got to cover the sales, marketing, ops, and finance, and then, you know, capitalization of the business. If you have multiple founders, the best case scenario when the co-founders all kind of tackle one functional area and they have sales expertise, or they are coming with consumer marketing, or they are a back of the house kind of person and are really comfortable in ops and finance. And so, you know, it's important to understand the different roles in the business and then understand what your strengths and weaknesses are and where you could have the biggest impact. From there, you could put a hiring plan together. Like my example, I'm naturally more of an operations and finance person. My mom was an accountant. Finance comes really easy for me. But as a founder, I knew I had to grow as a sales and marketing person. And to grow in sales and marketing, I couldn't be doing the ops and finance piece of the business. And so we had another co-founder that was covering ops, but one of my first hires was a controller to do all the day-to-day entry and accounting entry so I could just go and spend all my time with customer and consumer, because that's where I was really going to be able to drive value in the business.
Do you think that founders can outsource sales?
You can, but it's more challenging. I think some of the best founders, most successful entrepreneurs, are, you know, have a marketing talent to them, have a sales talent to them, either natural or developed. And they put a lot of energy there because you got to understand your consumer that's buying your product and be able to communicate more with them. And then sales, like, you know, understanding distributors and brokers and retailers and trade relationships and what's important to them, like outsourcing that, especially too early on, just seems so dangerous compared to, you know, taking the time and going to school, educating yourself on how you can be better.
One piece of advice I got from Ibrahim here from A Dozen's Cousins was that, you know, as a founder, he goes out to all the key like selling meetings, but then hire someone to do sales support. Right? Like that as a founder, that wasn't providing the incremental value for his time. And that's something that he could hire for. So after the deal went through, someone to fill out all the paperwork and make sure everything was correct. But he was always kind of the face during the sales, which worked really well and also freed up the other time.
Yeah. And I think that's myself as well. Even when we grew Harvest to a $100 million business, I was out there with our sales team in key customer meetings because the founder can bring more marketing to the conversation. Like, why is the founder in the business? What, you know, what's the business's purpose? What's the vision and mission? And all of that is really critical in customer relationships. But it's hard for a trained salesperson to cover that aspect. But then when it gets to what's the new intro deal? What's the promotional allowance? What does the advertisements look like to support the retailer? The follow-up with all those pieces of it, you know, those are foundational sales roles and activities. And so that's where a founder and a salesperson can complement each other.
As founders are kind of navigating the financial landscape that we talked about a little earlier right now, do you think they should be focused on building to profitability first or focused on building growth first? I know it definitely is going to vary by situation, but as the maybe the default that founders should think about, what do you think?
Yeah, I think growth is important because it keeps people interested in the business and keeps more opportunities coming. I think gross margin is more important in the early years than profitability. You have to, because you're creating that product and depending on your supply chain, are you manufacturing yourself? Are you co-packed? What's, you know, what moats do you have around your formulation? So can you have a good solid gross margin? And I think for me, a target is 50% gross margin. And I know even people confuse like what makes up a gross margin. That's why, you know, we give away at fatafleischman.org. We have a proper CPG food and beverage P&L template that founders can use because, you know, you want to calculate your gross margin properly. But if you have a strong gross margin, you know, you're going to spend, especially as a startup, below the line for new people on your team and selling and marketing opportunities and your office and your kind of other infrastructure stuff. But if you have growth and a solid gross margin, then you're much more of a fundable business because you know that the equity dollars, they're going to go to growth. And when you continue that growth, you're going to have a strong margin. You know, if a business is already underway, then, you know, the most important thing is you got to protect your runway. And if you're not profitable, you know, you're going to hit a brick wall sooner or later if you don't bring in new equity. And we're going into a time which really reminds me of 2008, 2009, 2010. I lived through that at Mental Harvest. We were fortunate to grow the business through that because we had an equity partner, a private equity that, or venture capital that was involved in the business. But if you don't have that next round of equity, you need to be really conscious on how do you change your operational plan to preserve the runway of cash and your capital.
I think that's a great thing as well. And all the founders listening in, make sure you have that cash to continue on and stay in business and to build your vision into reality. Because it's probably going to get a little bit easier the next couple of years, but there's not going to be the floodgate of funds coming into the industry as it was before. Mike, thanks so much for being on today and talking about what founders can do to really drive success in their business.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.